This, the second hour of our second Planetary Tantra talk, was recorded just 15 hours before the horrendous Kanto Pacific earthquake that occurred on the 11th of March, 2011, just before 3 p.m. Japanese time. I find it very interesting that we talked about death so much in this talk, and that, as many people can testify to, I was going on and on about the intense energies I was feeling in the few days leading up to the earthquake. At a later date, I would like to explain the experience I had during the unleashing of these powerful earth energies. For now, though, let me suffice to say that while I was 100% certain of not only the existence of Gaia Sophia as a living, extremely intelligent goddess, and of one's ability to tap into and communicate with her, the experience I had has raised that certainty to a rock-solid level in my mind. With that said, please enjoy this second hour and look forward to upcoming talks as well. Okay, and welcome to part two of our second Planetary Tantra talks. As I said in the introduction to the first part, our first recording was done under not the best of circumstances. It sounded like John was speaking to me from behind a waterfall, and I was just straining to catch much of the conversation. Hopefully tonight we have a little bit better connection, and I would just like to pick up things as from the point where we had left off. At the closing there, John, you were saying that we are the creation of Gaia in a biological sense, and in a much more deeper sense, we are the creative creations of her from her imaginings in the Pleroma. And you wanted to start to talk about how Gaia Sophia views the opposition that has developed through this anomalous event with the creation of the Archons, and how that opposition has developed opposed to the divine experiment. So if you wanted to continue on with that train of thought, we're ready for that.
Yes, I'd like to proceed in that way. I find, after many years of immersion in the Gnostic materials, which are, needless to say, very difficult to make sense of, yet I feel a certain sense of confidence in speaking from that myth now. So I'll do the best I can to show what a tremendous advantage we gained through this myth. It's not like any other myth. It's actually a participatory myth. The vision story of Sophia allows us to actually participate in the experience of the divine being whose presence is the earth. And it's a fantastic interactive experiment. So I like this term, the divine experiment. I suggest we use this term to explain the human purpose on earth. After all, we have this perennial question, you know, who are we, where do we come from, and what are we doing here on earth? Well, the Gnostic myth of the fallen goddess, the divine Sophia, answers those questions in simple and elementary and elegant manner. In the first place, it answers the question, who are we and where do we come from? The dual question. The myth tells us that the human species, the anthropos as it's called, the human genome, if you will, is a product of divine engineering and divine imagination, and that we actually originate off this planet. but we do not originate in any other star system or in any other planet. The human species originates from the galactic core. And we are the product of the imagination of the divine beings in the galactic core, the aeons, particularly a pair of aeons, which are usually described as Sophia and Christos. So the next question is, well, what are we doing here on Earth? Well, our existence here, our evolution, is an expression of a divine experiment set in motion by these pleromic divinities at the galactic center. So that kind of sums up the background of what I want to say now. If we consider that we are this divine experiment, then we may also ask ourselves, well, how does the originator of this divine experiment see it? How does Sophia, or Gaia Sophia herself, see the divine experiment that we are now undergoing? And how does she see us at the particular stage we're at right now? I find it really fantastic that this myth actually allows us to explore that question. It gives us the framework and the language and syntax for actually formulating that question and answering it. So I'm going to answer it now to the best of my ability. As far as the divine experiment goes, in Sophia's original vision, it was a situation in which she perceived that one strain of the human species, the Anthropos, would have a three-body system to evolve in. And that three-body system is called in the Gnostic writings by a very weird technical name in Latin, the trimorphic protonoia.
Trimorphic protonoia?
Yeah, the trimorphic protonoia. This is actually the name of a Gnostic document, and you'll find this, it's one of the documents, one of the texts in the Nag Hammadi library. And what the trimorphic protonoia means, as I explain in the commentaries on the Nag Hammadi library that are on metahistory.org, trimorphic means three body, three form. And protonoia means original intention. Proto means original, and enoia means intention. And what we learn from deciphering this complex terminology is that when Sophia, who dreamed to the Earth and dreamed an experiment with the human species, was in the galactic core, she had a particular version of that dream in her mind. And in that version, humanity, as we are today, would emerge in a three-body system, trimorphic. She saw us in a world consisting of a planet circulating around a star, and circulating around the planet would be a satellite or moon. It would be a three-body system. She saw us, or previsioned the experiment with humanity, in a three-body setting. And that's how she pictured it. And she was fascinated by the possibilities that would emerge for humanity if we had this three-body setting. If we had a planetary habitat, a satellite circulating the planet, and a sun, which the planet circulated. And there probably are planetary systems like this in our galaxy. Yeah, because we know now that there are countless stars that have planetary systems around them. So this is how she initially envisioned it. But as it turned out, it didn't really work out that way. Because the myth tells us that something happened that was an anomou, A-N-A-M-O-U, in Greek, meaning an anomaly, a deviance, something unexpected happened. And as the myth explains, and you have propounded this beautifully in your narration of the myth, when Sophia was drawn from the galactic core by her fascination for the human experiment, her plasmic wave of organic light created a fracture zone in the galactic limbs. And in that fracture zone, a planetary system arose, basically of inorganic matter, an inorganic realm of celestial mechanics. And in that planetary system, the Earth arose and it was captured in that system. So we are actually living in a planetary system which was not what Sophia herself envisioned in the beginning. This is what the myth tells us. So, I've been thinking about this a lot since we had our last conversation and wondering how I might make this rather esoteric and complicated cosmology accessible to people and make it understandable. I've been thinking about this a great deal. So what I'd like to do now is just step out of the cosmological or astronomical picture and just go into a more user-friendly kind of description and see if you can put yourself in Sophia's viewpoint by the description that I give. Suppose that there's a group of people, 100 people, in a class taught by a teacher, and this is a class in natural sciences. And the teacher is a woman, and she's a very gifted teacher, and she understands very deep things about nature, and she wants to show her class how to interact with nature, how to discover the secrets of nature, and how to do experiments and actually produce things, produce inventions, and create forms of culture and forms of survival by a deep understanding of nature. In order to achieve this aim, the teacher of the class wants to take her 100 students out on a field trip. So imagine that we go out on this field trip with the teacher, and she's very excited and very happy because she has along with her 100 prize students, and she's going to show them things in nature. They're going to camp out, they're going to study the land, study the behavior of animals, they're going to do all these things in their field trip. And the purpose of the field trip with the teacher is so that the students can become educated in the ways and designs of nature, and they can then co-evolve and cooperate with nature. This is the aim of the teacher. If you would accept that simple analogy, you would understand after a manner of thinking how Gaia conceived the human experiment and how she conceived her involvement in it. She thought that humanity would emerge, a particular strain of humanity, because there are many strains in our universe, in our galaxy, there are hundreds of strains of humanity. But one particular strain would emerge in a three-body system. And she, as a divine entity, would radiate her consciousness into that system and would teach the human beings how to discover the mysteries and wonders of that system and how to realize their full potential as co-creators. This was her dream. Is that clear so far?
That's very clear, yeah. So she's envisioning working together and teaching and guiding her the anthropos that she created in the Pleroma in a three-body system. It wouldn't have outside influences of Saturn.
That's right. It would have no outside influences of any other inorganic planets. Okay?
Yeah.
And you understand that the reason why she fell from the Pleroma, and this is the metaphor of fall, the reason why is because aeons didn't usually do that. Aeons would, the divinities of the Pleroma will seed and engineer an experiment, and then they will release it into the galactic limbs, and they will let it evolve on their own terms. And generally, they don't intrude in the experiment. They don't get involved. They kind of sit back and watch. That's their pleasure. That's their entertainment.
Right.
Okay? But she was the exception because she was so passionately attached to this anthropos species that she wanted to be involved with it in this three-body system. Is that clear?
Very clear, yes.
Okay. So let's go back now to the analogy of the field trip. The 100 students are going off on this field trip together. They packed all their gear. They're following the teacher, who is Sophia herself, Gaia Sophia. And then they proceed to spend their time out there in nature, but something happens that the teacher did not foresee. And here I'm going to quote a statistic that I came across. I've mentioned this to you before. I came across this statistic on researching the term interspecies predators on the internet, because I introduced this term, interspecies predators, in some of my writings on right action. And then I went and found out that other people have also been using this term. Doesn't matter who originated it. What matters is that we understand what an interspecies predator is. An interspecies predator does not exist in any other species but the human species. Because when you look at all the species of nature, you find, oh shit, I don't want to fuck this up. Donkeys, camels, serpents, whatever you want. Each species has its own rules and boundaries and instincts, but species do not prey upon themselves. There is some anomaly. There is some weird, dangerous deviance in the human species that causes it to prey upon itself. And the papers that I found, and they're quite serious scholarly papers written by sociologists and psychologists, mention this statistic. They say that in any human community or culture or nation, about 4-5% of the members of that community will be psychopaths. So let's take that statistic and apply it to the field trip. Let's say that 100 students, including us lucky ones, prize students in Gaia's class, are going out on the field trip. But of those 100, 5 are psychopaths. We won't get into why right now they became psychopaths. That's another lecture. But just say 5 of them are psychopaths. Now, we have to just take a minute and we have to profile what a psychopath is. Psychopath is a human being, basically has 3 traits. One is they lack empathy. That is to say, they don't feel what other people feel. They don't care. So they can see a person be harmed and not care. And they can harm someone and not care what effect that has. The second trait is that they are extremely clever and manipulative. Perhaps even cleverer than people who have empathy. They have kind of an edge. And the third trait of a psychopath is that they're extremely adaptive. They use deception. They can appear to be very charming. They don't stand out. You don't look across the room at a party and see the psychopath standing against the wall with the sinister shadows around it, you know? The psychopath is very likely to be the most popular person at the party. Okay? So, in this field trip of 100 people, 5 of them are psychopaths, and they are mingled with the rest of the other 95. And what the teacher did not expect, and this is what Gaia did not expect, is that these 5 psychopaths would attempt to completely derail the experiment, and they would attempt to ruin the field trip. And so they proceed to do this by using their cleverness, by using their manipulative abilities, and by acting in a complete lack of empathy. They put the lives of the other members of the field trip in danger. They threaten the experiment. So the situation that we're in on Earth at this time can be summed up in this way. We are involved as human species in a divine experiment with the originator of that experiment. One of the originators. Because the myth says that in the Pleroma at the galactic core, the human genome was engineered by two aeons coupled. Sophia and Christos. But Christos isn't here on Earth. Christos remains with the other divinities in the Pleromic Center. And the only divinity on Earth is the aeon who actually morphed into the Earth. So we are on Earth involved in a divine experiment with the originator of that experiment. But there is not a flaw in the experiment. There is an unforeseen development. Sophia did not foresee completely that some part of the human species would turn against its own kind and try to ruin and sabotage the divine experiment. And that is the situation that we're in today. And so, if we feel empathy for the goddess, if we can really feel empathy for her, and I'm not talking now about fantasy or make-believe, I'm talking about a real situation in which very profound things are at stake in this divine experiment on Earth. First of all, our own survival is at stake, because we cannot survive unless we recognize the existence of interspecies predators in our midst. But also, from her point of view, her vision of our potential, her vision of our fantastic giftedness and our talent, which she endowed in us when she constructed the genome, is under threat because of this weird development. And so if you allow the story, take this story on board, and if you allow this story to work in your imagination, it can produce empathy for her situation, and at the same time, it can situate us in what our situation really is, what it is that we are really facing here on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, it all becomes very crystal clear. You start to see things in the proper perspective.
I think so, Thomas. I think that this myth, the Sophianic vision story, is a tremendous corrective to our view of the human situation. Basically, the only thing that Sophia wanted for us was discovery, play, invention, the joy of learning. The joy of learning how to create, in human terms, a paradise on Earth. We're already in a paradise. The Earth is a paradise. It's a natural paradise. But we are not living the Edenic truth of that paradise because something has deviated us from our potential. If she had it her way completely, and the Earth had not become captured in the planetary system of the Archons, there would be no deviance. We would make mistakes, but we would correct them and learn from them, and we would proceed to go on. So I'd like to get more into a dialogue mode with you here in just a minute. But before we go to that, I want to make one more statement that I really ask the listeners to stop and reflect on this statement I'm going to make right now, because I strongly feel that this statement is a key to our understanding of not only the danger we face on this planet, but also the solution to getting beyond that danger and getting back to alignment with Sophia. Try to imagine that in Sophia's vision of the divine experiment with humanity, there would be no problem that could arise among human beings that they could not handle. So we could create societies, communities, tribes. We could even create cities together. We could create big cities, or we could live in small groups, or we could live in large groups together. Totally a matter of choice. Problems would arise. Differences with human beings would arise. Conflicts would arise, but nothing would arise that we could not handle and solve ourselves. Try to imagine that, and then go to the next step. And this is where the perception of evil becomes accessible. In Gaia's view, in Sophia's view, the only problems that could not be solved between human beings by goodwill and cooperation would be problems that were deliberately created. And that's what she did not foresee in the beginning of her vision. She foresaw that our divine experiment would involve problems, would involve learning, trial and error. But she endowed us with a self-correcting ability. She endowed us with imagination. She endowed us with the will to cooperate with each other. And if you make a mistake, I can help you see what it is. And if I make a mistake, you can help me see. She endowed us with this generosity and this cooperative spirit. But what she did not count on was that some human beings would deliberately create and orchestrate problems for others. And those problems cannot be solved. That is the danger. That is the danger we face right now. The problems facing the world, the energy crisis, terrorism, flus and diseases that are going to ravage the human race, the financial problems that are bringing down nations, none of these problems can be solved. Why not? Because they're deliberately created. And we are only equipped, according to our divine potential, to solve problems that are not deliberately created. And this is such an important key to understand, not only in facing the terrible orchestrations of evil that are taking place on our planet right now, but also in going beyond that and really going to solution, which is a solution that we can achieve in connection with the goddess.
So you're saying the source of that evil then is the anomalous event that happened that created the Archons. That was totally unexpected, and the results of that are the influence that has affected the minds of a small percentage of society, but through that influence they've been able to amass great powers to themselves and propagate their own devious games. And you're saying that we aren't equipped inherently to deal with that. So where do we turn then if we're not equipped with that function?
Well, this goes in the direction that I'm suggesting. Something that we need to look at very carefully. I wouldn't necessarily say that we're not equipped to deal with that, but it wasn't anticipated. Let's go back to the field trip again. There's 100 students on the field trip, and unbeknownst to either the students or the teacher, 5 of the students in that group of 100 want to sabotage the whole trip. They want to kill a good part of the people on the trip, and they want to ruin the whole experiment. And they're doing it deliberately. So what we don't expect that. We don't expect that. You can imagine the surprise and the bafflement in the other 95 members of the field trip when they suddenly begin to realize something is going wrong with this field trip, and it's not just going wrong by itself. It's being deliberately orchestrated to go wrong.
Yeah.
By actual members among us. Okay? This is the point where we got to snap real fast. Real fast.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably the point I would suggest where humanity, those of us who accept the spirit of generosity and coexistence, would say this is the basis of human nature and human society, generosity and coexistence. Those who accept that have to snap really fast to the realization that all the problems that are happening in the world today that we can't be solved are deliberate, and that it's time to confront the deliberate perpetrators of those problems.
I am in total agreement with you. It's not a time to try and shower these crazy people with love and just hope they'll come around to the kind of nature that most people on the planet have. They're obviously not going to respond to acts of generosity and kindness on our part. We have to come up with a totally different approach.
We have to come up with a totally different approach, which is the warrior approach.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what we find is that, in a sense, I mean, we need to talk about this subject now in a new way, in a different way, and look for approaches to the subject. But in a sense, what we find is that the goddess, the earth goddess, Gaia Sophia, needs our help, that we have to rally to a warrior's position in regard to the predators in our own midst. And no compassion, no love, and no forgiveness for those people is going to make one whit of difference. And so there is a sense in which I can say with total conviction that your love and commitment to the earth would have to be balanced by your warrior stance toward these predators. And you're absolutely right. Love is totally wasted on them. Love ain't going to do nothing.
Absolutely. And that ties into the concept of love that Sophia herself has. This isn't a bend over, you know, and let people run slipshod all over you. That's not her
That's
approach.
Right.
You know,
That's not her
nature.
Approach.
If something gets out of line, it's cut off immediately.
That's right.
I would just like to say, John, that when I first connected into the Dakinis of the Shakti cluster, the energies that I felt from that were not cutie, you know, daisy type stuff. This was an intense anger, intense, just almost violent. I don't want to use that word, but a very strong anger towards the nutcases that are destroying the planet. That just came through in spades.
It does come through.
Yeah,
it does.
So it's a different type of an energy. This is not a play toy type of a thing.
Not at all. I've explained in some of the writings on planetary tantra that while it's natural for humanity to recognize the loving and nurturing qualities of the goddess Earth, because she is our mother, she is the mother of all sentient creatures, and she nurtures us, she provides us with what we eat, what we drink, she provides us with the air we breathe. I'm not denying any of that. But what we encounter today is the rage of the goddess, the rage of the divine feminine against these interspecies predators, and the rage that Sophia herself feels that her treasured species, humanity, would harbor these perpetrators. And so when we connect with her now, it's essential in that connection to recognize the factor of rage and to take on that rage and become warriors in her defense.
I'm in total agreement with you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you know, since this is coming from two individuals right now, these kind of statements, that we are kind of putting ourselves in a little bit of a precarious position. But I will say very directly and clearly right here that it doesn't bother me at all. I'm not going to shrink back from pursuing these areas of exploration. And obviously, you're not either. So
no, I'd like to make this statement.
Please.
This is the first time that I've talked about this. There are a couple of stages here, folks. And the first stage, and approach both of them with extreme caution. The first stage is recognize and own your own rage that you feel regarding what is happening to this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's going to be a big surprise to anyone. I know that there are millions of people on this planet who are in a state of rage about what is being done, not only to the Earth, to the rape of the resources of the Earth, to the accumulation of all the resources of the Earth, including the very water we drink and the air we breathe, by a bunch of financial and military predators. Not only that rage, but the rage for the destruction of the soul life of humanity through the media, through the lies and hoaxes and deceptions that we're subjected to every day. You and I, Thomas, are not the only two people standing here who feel that rage.
Absolutely.
And I speak to that rage, and Kali speaks to that rage. And Kali says, honor that rage. First of all, own it. Take it on board, because Gaia needs you to feel that rage in her behalf. That's the first step. Now, what are we going to do with that rage?
Mm-hmm.
That's another story. Okay? And that's something we can get into in the near future. We shall get into that in the near future. But the first thing to do is to own and recognize the rage and realize that it is totally valid, and that in fact, it's going to connect you with the divine goddess energy by which we live. And it's going to boost your ability to face what humanity is facing. Okay? Is that clear?
That is very clear. Yeah, and to not feel rage at this point of the game is actually very abnormal.
Yeah, and suicidal as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
You know, you would have to be really pathetic if you don't feel rage, you know. I mean, thank the goddess for the internet, you know, because through the internet, we have come to have an alternative, not only alternative source of news and information, but alternative interpretations of what's happening. And one of the interpretations that we find on the internet is that we are being hoaxed and deceived in every aspect of our life, in every aspect of society. And I don't know about anyone else, but if I go up to the local store here in Spain and buy something, or if I go into the gas station and buy something, or go into a store and buy a product, and somebody hoaxes me and deceives me, I'm angry. I'm angry about that. I don't just sit back and take it. And humanity right now, why is humanity possibly facing a planetary shift? Well, my answer to that would be, we're facing a planetary shift because we're realizing that we are being hoaxed and deceived, and that the proper and sane reaction to that is rage. And rage is a quality of the divine feminine just as much as her nurturing and loving qualities are. So it can be quite enlightening to consider the myth in this way, and to consider the myth as a teaching tool. But nothing concerning the myth of Gaia Sophia is passive. It's an entirely interactive myth. And the challenge of this myth is to connect it directly to your experience. I don't know about anyone else, but in my experience as a single guy walking around this planet, I get very angry if anyone rips me off and cheats me and deceives me, even if they try to do it. And if I go to a local store or a gas station, or I buy a product and I come back home and find out that I've been deceived and ripped off, not that a mistake has been making. Mistakes are honest. Mistakes are legitimate. But that I have been intentionally and deliberately cheated and ripped off, I get angry. So what I am proposing here is that everyone who becomes involved in Gaia's story and has empathy for Gaia Sophia will feel tremendous anger and rage that her experiment in creating a paradise on Earth with the human species has been deviated and sabotaged by certain members within the human species. This is the situation we face. And when you face it honestly and courageously, you connect with her and you become a champion, as it were, or a collaborator in her purposes.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And you kind of get the feeling that when you do connect into the mind of Gaia Sophia for the first time or the first few times, you kind of get the feeling that she's just waiting for someone to tap into her. She's like, here you go. Thank you for calling me. Here's what I'll give you, as much as energy as you need to take care of these things. And it will astound you how immediately she responds.
This is true. This is true. She is predisposed. The living, divine, animating intelligence of the Earth is predisposed to make this human connection. She longs for it. She looks for it. And so when we come to her seeking that connection, she responds. And I can tell you with total confidence that this is not make-believe. And if you want to test what I'm saying, you do the Gaian Tantra vow.
Yeah.
And you'll find out whether it's true or not.
I would say that's the best thing to do. You know, let's be scientific about this. Let's test out what works and what doesn't. And so you can't poo-poo things until you try it. You know, go out in the mountains or wherever you feel comfortable and take the Gaian vow and do it with a sense of in a sense of a seriousness, in a sense, but you know, play with it, see how it feels, and see what happens.
Do it with a sense of the urgency of the situation, but also do it just with a sense of, well, I wonder what the fuck's going to happen. You know, I mean, that's a legitimate feeling. We are a playful species. We are an experimental species, and one of the virtues of the human mind is that we don't have to be locked and bounded by our own prejudices and prejudgments. We can keep the mind open to experiment and discovery. So read about the Gaian Tantric Vow on Planetary Tantra on metahistory.org and go out into nature and call her name and see what happens.
Yeah, very good. That's the most direct practical advice you can get. Wonderful.
As far as I know, it is.
Yeah, I agree. And John, talking about the analogy, to go back to that for a second here, a thought that came to my mind when you were leading us through that was, we can picture, you know, 95 of us just playing and having fun and learning things from the teacher. And meanwhile, there's these five deviants out there doing everything they can to derail things. And what the thought that crossed my mind is that these five might kind of spot that the other four are kind of thinking the same thing that they are and doing the same games. So they might kind of join together in a little bit of a loose alliance, at least for some time. But since these guys are all crazy and nutcakes anyway, when they start to see that they're getting close to what they want to achieve, they're going to start attacking the other guys as well. And I think that is also what we're seeing on the world stage right now, that these groups that were kind of loosely aligned now are kind of attacking themselves as well. And that can be part of the way that they're going to be brought down, is they're going to gnaw at each other, you know. I just wonder what your take on that is.
This is such a helpful observation. I'm so glad that you brought this into the conversation at this moment. This is such a helpful observation. The natural tendency of psychopaths and the deviant, deceptive manipulators is to conspire with each other. They conspire with each other for a number of reasons. One is that they share the same aims or purposes, namely to steal all the resources of the earth, to screw everybody else out of their natural birthright, to deceive people, to harm people. They naturally gravitate toward each other because they share these purposes. They also share the same MO. As I said, the profile of a psychopath is something that every responsible human being must understand. I'm telling you right now that if you consider yourself to be a conscionable, awake, and responsible human being, and you don't know what the profile of a psychopath is, then you're a fraud, and you're not doing your job, okay? And another aspect of their profile is that they enjoy deceiving and manipulating, and so they will conspire to that end. But you point out something that is most essential to understand. As they get close to achieving their game, they start to fight in their own ranks because they are essentially deviant, devious, untrusting, selfish, and obsessively power-dominated. They're dominated by the illusion of power. I would like to perhaps dedicate another one of our interviews to the question of what is the illusion of power. Why do they have power? Why do the NEWOs, I call them the NEWOs, N-E-W-O, the New World Order control freaks, why do the NEWOs have so much power? They have so much power because we, who are their prey, buy into the illusion of power that they live in. They live in an illusion, but if we buy into that illusion and subscribe to it, we support that illusion. And it's extremely enlightening and liberating to look into the illusions of power in order to free ourselves from that bondage. But getting back to your comment, Thomas, I want to say that this is absolutely true. And I observed, in fact, in October of 2008 and moving into 2009, that the NEWOs started to crack up. And even as they appear to be getting very close to some of their goals, their control grid and their control system is really intense. They're really pushing for it. They are committing suicide. We don't hear about these things, but they're happening. They are killing each other. They are killing their own minions. And this is going to continue. So the good news is, to some extent, to a certain degree, we can count on them destroying themselves. And we can count on a breakdown in their own ranks. Can count on that, but not entirely. We still need to take the warrior position toward predators. And that is part of this. That is the signature and the proof that you are dedicated to the planet and to the sanity and beauty of human potential, is that you take this warrior position.
Absolutely. I mean, just think about it. You know, in life, there is a point where you're going to die. You know, it's going to happen. And do you want to go to your death with the knowledge in your heart that you've done everything you can to ensure that your offspring and that the future of humanity is going in the proper direction? Or do you just want to die thinking you've sold out to yourself and to humanity? It's, you know, something you need to really kind of face, look in the mirror and face yourself with.
Sure, as Castaneda said, you know, death is the advisor to the warrior.
Yeah.
And there's an old cliche, but I love to repeat it because I live it every day. Anything worth doing is worth dying for.
Yeah, and you even actually said in a mail to me a while back was that if you don't have something that is worth dying for, you're not really alive.
You haven't found your true purpose as a human being, and you're not really alive.
Yeah.
And the one of the wonderful beauties of that old cliche is that those of us who join as defenders and warriors for Gaia will all know that we are dying for the same cause. And that is a beautiful solidarity and a very, very powerful weapon against the predators.
Yeah. You're not doing it alone,
Not alone. You are not alone. You're not alone in your rage. You're not alone in your despair. You're not even alone in your confusion and your bafflement about how things could go so terribly wrong. I'll tell you in a New York minute how things can go terribly wrong with a divine experiment. There's only one way that the divine experiment of Gaia Sophia can go wrong, and that is if it is deliberately misdirected by human beings. Otherwise, it cannot go wrong.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. Well, John, let me ask you one more thing before we sign off for today. In the first part of our interview, you were talking about Melchizedek and the what appears to be the Holy Grail that he's holding in his left hand. You never did get around to explaining what you thought that represented.
What he's holding in his hand?
Yeah.
It's like a Slurpee that you get at the 7-Eleven.
It's a Slurpee.
Yeah.
An orange one or a grape one, or what is that?
I think it's a grape flavored fake orange peach smelling Slurpee made from distilled sewage that comes out of the Baltimore. I think that's basically what it is.
I think you're right. I think that's what the Prince of Darkness would drink, yeah.
Yeah, he would drink that. The Prince of Darkness is the biggest fraud on the planet, you know? The only evil that threatens the human species is the evil of our own projections. There's no evil in the world. Gnostics were extremely clear on stating that point. There's no evil except the evil of human projections, the evil of human behavior. There's no cosmic principle of evil. There's no Satan. Or if Satan does exist, I challenge him to show up on my terrace this afternoon.
Yeah.
Show up. Show up if you exist, Satan, you know? Show up. So it's wonderful to know, in the confidence of the divine Sophia, that there is no evil in this experiment, and there is fear no evil because there is no evil, but there is evil behavior on the part of human beings.
Yeah, on the part of the humans, yeah.
That's right.
Okay, very good, John. And for the people listening to this second installment of this talk, when your friends ask you what John Lash has been talking about, you can sum it up by saying that Melchizedek drinks a great sewer Slurpee, and they'll get the message really good. To make t-shirts like that, huh?
Yeah, really. Yeah.
All right, John. Well, I thank you again for today, and I look forward to our next outing in a little bit less than 2 weeks.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
Exactly. Me as well. It's a great pleasure and a privilege. Thank you so much.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right.
Good night.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.